Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Fueling Forward podcast. I'm your host, registered dietitian, and former professional runner, Maddie Alm. Today's episode is a Q&A where I'll be answering questions that have been submitted to me beforehand by listeners. And if you would like to submit a question for a future Q&A episode, you can do so on my website at www.fuelingforward.com under the podcast tab, or you can email me at fuelingforwardpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed today's Q&A episode. Hi, everyone. Welcome back. Happy Friday. I hope you're all having a great week, or you had a great week. It's so hard to believe that I'm almost exactly a week away from the marathon. On Sunday, it'll be my last like longish run. Yesterday, we did our last workout. We just did like 6 by a mile, starting at race pace and getting a little bit faster. I'm definitely feeling like more fit than I felt since I retired running, obviously. So it's been really fun to kind of like find a little bit of fitness again. It's been fun to like feel stronger each week. And it definitely, I understand a little bit more, I would say, like the marathon culture. I always said when I was running professionally and running so much, I was like, man, when I'm done running, like I don't really have any desire to do something like train for a marathon. But after having taken, you know, a year and a half away from structured training, I kind of start to see the appeal a little bit. I'm like, okay, it's nice to have some structure. It's nice to have something to train for, and it's nice to have a goal at the end of this. So yeah, it's been a pleasant surprise, I would say, overall. And even the long runs, you know, like the longest I had run when I was training was 16 miles, and I've done 2 runs now that are longer than that, which is crazy. I never thought I would say that. So I have had so much fun actually this block. And my husband, Nick, and I have been training together. He's going to be running with me in the marathon, which is going to be so fun. And it's just been really nice to train with him. It's great to like spend time together outside away from distractions and just basically like have a 2.5 hour conversation on long run days. And that's been really fun. I'm definitely going to miss that aspect of training when we're done. So yeah, it's been super great. We leave super early Thursday morning. It's really crazy that leaving from LA to New York, it's the same, the flight is the same length as going from New York to Europe. It's a 6-hour flight. So it's a long travel day, and not to mention it's a 3-hour time difference. So like race morning, we're going to have to get up at, you know, 4 a.m. in New York, which is going to be like 1 a.m. in LA. So that's going to be a little tough, but it's going to be such a fun weekend. Nick actually has 3 brothers. 2 of them are in New York and 1 is in DC. So his whole family is coming down for the race. His parents are coming out. My parents are coming out. We have a couple friends that are in the area that are going to come down and watch the race. So we're going to have a really big support crew, which is going to be awesome. And it's just going to be a really fun weekend overall. So I'm very excited. I feel like I've learned just a lot over this block, and the block as a whole has been like overall really good. I think there's been some ups and downs, you know, some of which I'll probably share later on, but it has been, I would say, overall positive experience. And race day wise, in terms of a goal, just, you know, putting it out there, just because I believe in saying your big goals out loud, our A goal for the race is to break 3 hours, which I definitely think is going to be doable, but I don't think it's going to be easy. That's been my biggest goal with this kind of whole marathon training approach, is not to expect anything because of my history as a runner. I think it's easy to fall into the mindset of like, I deserve to run fast because I had, you know, all this time training, or like just to expect it to be handed to me because, you know, back when I was training hard, I ran a really fast half marathon. And, you know, those are things it's easy to say like, well, I did this once, so of course it should be easy for me to break 3 hours. I'm under no illusion that that's going to be the case. Breaking 3 hours is no joke. You're running, it's basically 650 mile pace. And I know that's going to be hard. So my goal is to respect that, you know, respect the marathon. I've never done one before. And I know that it, especially in New York, you've got hills, you've got a big hill at mile 21. So I know that there's a lot of barriers to achieving that goal. But I also want to put it out there and just say, you know what, I'm going to go for it. But I also know that at the end of the day on race day, whether or not I run that time, I'm going to feel so proud and accomplished when I cross the line. It's just such a big feat to do that. So I know we can at least finish the marathon. Sounds silly to say, but like when we were starting, I was genuinely like, I don't know about that. Like when we did our 13-mile long run, I was like, I'm sorry, I have to run twice this distance. Like, I don't even think I could have run 5 more miles at the, you know, effort we were running at. But that's why you train. You know, we ran 20 miles 2 weeks ago. And then I was like, okay, you know what? I probably could have run 6.2 more miles. I think I could do it. So I at least feel confident that I can finish. I know I can finish. My A goal is obviously to break 3 hours. My B goal is just to finish strong and have fun, which is really why I'm doing this in the first place. And I am, of course, doing this as a charity runner for Track Girls, which is an incredible nonprofit organization working to create resources to help keep girls in sport. And I have 1 week left to meet my donation goal of $4,500. And I'm just less than $1,000 away from that goal. So I'm super close. Thank you so much to everybody who has donated so far. It has been so incredible just to see the outpouring of support from the Fueling Forward community. Thank you, everyone. If you are able to and would like to make a donation, I'll put the link to donate in the show notes. And I also am partnering with Hedda's to do a donation-based giveaway. So for every $50 you donate, you get one entry to win a race day support package. And this includes a free pair of Hedda's shoes, a t-shirt, a race day strategy Zoom call with me, and then more from brands who believe in women's sports, much higher than a $50 value. So definitely a cool giveaway incentive if that's something you guys are interested in. So yeah, if you'd like to enter, you can do so by donating. But yeah, this is my last Q&A episode before the marathon. So I just wanted to give you guys a little bit of a recap on my training and my goals for the race. And if you'd like to track me on race day, you can find my name. I opted into tracking. So if you search my name in the New York Marathon app, you should be able to see me. I have no idea what my bib number is. I'll post that on Instagram when I find it, when I go pick it up. But feel free to track me and follow along if you'd like. There should be coverage as well on TV. You probably won't see me on TV, but you'll see a lot of people running and you get to see the pros, and it's going to be really fun. I always love watching marathon coverage on TV. So Sunday morning, and good news, Sunday morning will also be daylight savings. So technically you get an extra hour of sleep, especially if you're somebody on the West Coast who wants to get up and watch the marathon. It's an early start. So you get at least an extra hour of sleep. But yeah, all dialed in, ready to go. And thanks everyone for following along with my marathon journey. I'm looking forward to giving you guys the recap in a couple weeks. Last thing before I jump into today's questions, an exciting Fueling Forward announcement. I just hired my first new dietitian, Alexa Ephraimson. She's Alexa Guzman now. She just got married a couple months ago, and she is going to be an incredible addition to the team. She was actually on the podcast, so you can go back and listen to her episode if you want to learn a little more about her. She went pro right out of high school, and then she kind of struggled in her pro career due to underfueling. So she ended up, you know, retiring from professional running. She went on to become a registered dietitian, and now she is working with me and helping provide some great resources for younger athletes. She'll primarily be working with high school and college runners. So if you are interested in working with Alexa, you can apply to work one-on-one with her on our website, fuelingforward.com, and she will be taking on clients in November. So if you'd like to schedule an exploratory call, they're free. You can meet her, talk a little bit about your goals. You can do that on the website. And then I personally will also be opening up some new one-on-one coaching spots in November. So if you're interested in working with me, same thing, head to the website, fuelingforward.com, fill out a one-on-one coaching application, and you can schedule a free exploratory call to talk, and we can chat and see if we'd be a good fit. Okay, let's go ahead and jump into today's questions. The first question comes from Avery, and Avery says, "Hi there, I wanted to hear some good night snack ideas. Sometimes I'm not quite hungry after dinner, but I still like to finish the night with something sweet. I often try to incorporate tart cherry juice since it has sleep benefits. A favorite of mine is ice cream, so anything frozen and sweet is right up my alley. Thank you." Yeah, I love this question, and I first want to start by saying how much I encourage snacks before bed. I think there is this really big myth that we can't eat after a certain time. And that's actually not true. Our body is not a kitchen that closes at 6 o'clock or whatever. You can eat after dinner. The biggest thing with eating after dinner leading up to bedtime, it depends on the person, and it also depends on if you have things like reflux. So if you struggle with reflux, eating really close to bedtime can definitely make that worse. So that may be something to consider. Also, specific things that you eat like chocolate or mint can make reflux worse. So not having mint chocolate ice cream, for example, right before bed, if you have reflux, would be something to avoid. And generally, when you do eat closer to bedtime, you know, either propping yourself up with pillows or laying on your left side can actually help reduce reflux. So if that is a reason that you don't eat close to bed, you know, giving yourself, I would say, about 90 minutes before you lay down and after eating something. If you don't have reflux, then I still recommend trying to have something, you know, at least 30 minutes before going to bed. Give your body a little bit of time to digest so that you don't have any issues with digestion overnight. And a couple of, not rules of thumb, but things that I recommend thinking about when you're building a snack before bed. If we have something that affects blood sugar too acutely, so if we're seeing a lot of like spikes or major dips, that can disrupt sleep, but so can going to bed without eating enough. Underfueling and being hungry definitely can disrupt sleep overnight. And generally what I recommend is pairing some type of carb with protein and potentially some fat or fiber, depending again on what you're eating or how close you're eating to bed. So Avery said she loves ice cream. I love ice cream too. That is a great one. You could potentially make a milkshake with ice cream and add some milk or some protein powder to make it a little bit more substantial. Or you could just have regular old ice cream and enjoy it. You know, ice cream does have protein. It has calcium, it has carbs, it has fats in it. So a lot of those foods are actually inherently more balanced than we realize. Another option would be like a Greek yogurt based dessert. So Yasso Bar is a Greek yogurt like ice cream bar, and they're actually really good. I usually have two of them because they're small, but those are great. If you have two bars, you get 10 grams of protein and you get a good amount of carbs. And it also is kind of that like sweet treat feel, which I really like. And they actually just came out with like little pints, I think. So that's a good brand to look at if you want maybe like a more functional dessert. That's a good one. Another one that I really like is chia seed pudding. This one's a little polarizing because of the texture. A lot of people don't love the texture of chia seed pudding. I personally do. I love it. I love the flavor. I love the texture. It's all for me. But basically all you do is it's 2 tablespoons of chia seeds and 1/2 cup of liquid. So I'll use like Fairlife milk, which has a little more protein. You can add vanilla, maple syrup, add a little flavor. I like to top mine with fruit. You can add nuts on top as well. That's a super tasty snack before bed. Another one that's a great way to kind of get that sweetness but also balance is cereal and milk. And the reason why I love this one is because you can choose whatever kind of cereal sounds good to you. So if you want something sweeter, you could do like Cocoa Puffs, or you could do Reese's Puffs, or, you know, I don't know why I'm in the Puffs family, but whatever kind of cereal that you like, pairing that with milk, you're getting the protein from milk, you're getting the carbs from cereal. That's actually pretty balanced and a great snack to have before bed. And along that same vein, something like cookies and milk. You're getting the carbs from your cookies and you're getting protein from the milk. You know, potentially doing like a 2% or a whole fat milk. So you're also getting some fats in there, which can help stabilize blood sugar overnight. But those are some great options for bedtime snacks that are a little bit sweeter. Ninja Creamies are really big right now. So if you have like a Ninja Creamy, there's so many great recipes that you can make that are going to be a little like higher protein that are still kind of like an ice cream type option. Another one that I love is I make like an apple pie parfait. So you just like dice up an apple, add cinnamon and sugar or honey, whatever you like, and microwave it so the apples get really soft and kind of caramelized, and then top it with vanilla Greek yogurt. And it's so good. It's such a good little treat snack before bed. Yes. So all of that to say, I recommend some combination of carbs and protein, ideally getting a little bit of fat and or fiber in there to help stabilize blood sugar, and having this snack about 60 minutes before bed. This is super helpful if somebody is struggling with underfueling, if you're trying to get your period back, if you have a morning training session and you don't have as much time to eat beforehand, having a little extra before you go to bed can top off your energy stores. And same thing with the night before a race. Fun fact about me in college, one of my teammates and I would try to get a dessert before every race. So wherever we were, like I remember at Stanford, there was this really good crepe place that we would go and we would get dessert crepes. And then the hotel we would stay in had these like fancy bathrobes. And so we would eat dessert crepes in our bathrobes. That was like our pre-race tradition. Or in Seattle, we went to go get cupcakes the night before the race. That's something that I've actually done my whole career. I tell people this all the time. I had ice cream the night before my Olympic trials 5K. And the next day I had an incredible race. I made the final. I felt so good. So, you know, the last thing I'll say here is like, not eating dessert doesn't make you a better athlete, and eating dessert doesn't make you a worse athlete. It's okay to have these foods. You know, Avery said that she notices she has like a sweet tooth at night, which is totally fine, but also using that feedback to ask yourself, does that mean I'm missing something? A lot of times if an athlete has an extreme sweet tooth, that can be a sign that we're not getting enough carbs. So just something to be on the lookout for. But overall, I'm a big proponent of snacks before bed, totally fine if they're dessert focused, and just adding in that balance can help you feel a little more full and satisfied and help you sleep better. That is actually a great segue into this next question from Courtney. And Courtney says, I'm not fully caught up on listening to the podcast, so sorry if this question has already been answered. I'm currently training for my third marathon while in college, and I've been trying to focus on making sure I get enough fuel with all my training and classes, but sometimes I question if I am getting enough. I've started to wake up really hungry and was wondering if that's normal or a sign I'm underfueling. I only noticed this more recently after I started being more intentional about eating more. Super great question, Courtney. And I actually would say that being hungry when you wake up is a good thing. And that actually might be because you have been more intentional about your fueling. So something that can happen with underfueling is that your cortisol levels are higher in general. So cortisol is a stress hormone, and it also plays a role in blood sugar management. So if your body does not feel like it's getting enough fuel, if your blood sugar continues to drop too low, cortisol is something that helps your body maintain a higher blood sugar level. So for a lot of people, they notice that cortisol really disrupts their appetite. They might not ever really feel that hungry, or their appetite generally is blunted. So especially first thing in the morning, they're waking up and they're really not hungry. That's probably the biggest barrier, I would say, I hear from most athletes when it comes to eating breakfast. They say, I'm not hungry in the morning. So like I mentioned, that can be a sign of underfueling. That can be a sign that you're kind of running on stress hormones. So it is a good thing to feel hungry in the morning. You haven't eaten for the last, 10 hours. You should feel hungry when you wake up. But that said, if you're noticing that it's extreme, so like the hunger is waking you up before your alarm especially, or if the hunger is waking you up in the night, or maybe you're noticing it when you're going to bed, those can certainly be signs that maybe we're underfueling. So if you're noticing that your hunger is waking you up before your alarm, what you can try is what I just talked about earlier. Have a snack before bed. Make sure you add something in about an hour before you go to bed. And that can kind of help keep your blood sugar a little more stable, so you're not experiencing that kind of ravenous feeling before you actually wake up. You can also try having a little bit more for dinner. Maybe your dinner is not substantial enough. So making sure you're really balancing your plates with the carbs, color, protein, and fats at all of your meals, making sure that you're kind of spacing that out in general throughout the day. That hunger that either wakes you up in the night or before your alarm can be a reflection of either just having gone too long without eating, like I mentioned, or it can be because we're just not getting enough in the day. And especially what I see with athletes is like backloading the day. So the first half of their day, they're not eating as much. And then the second half of the day, they're starving. But by that point, they're kind of already in a deficit, and it's hard to actually physically eat enough to make up for that. So then you go to bed because you're really full, from a big dinner. then you wake up in the morning and you're starving. So just taking a look at your day and asking yourself, like, am I getting breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Am I eating about every 3 to 4 hours? Am I balancing meals and snacks? You know, am I eating about an hour before I go to bed? Do I have a big gap there? Those are some of the culprits I typically see for having extreme hunger that's waking you up in the morning or that's affecting you when it comes to going to sleep at night. Courtney mentioned that she only noticed that hunger in the morning after she started being more intentional about eating more. And that to me says probably what was happening beforehand was that she was maybe a little bit under in terms of fueling. And then when she started eating more, her cortisol level came down and her stress hormone levels have come down. And now that appetite suppression that was happening before has been improved. So now she's actually feeling that hunger in the morning, which this is where fueling gets easier when you kind of work towards recovering from underfueling because your appetite comes back. So now you're actually hungry in the morning. And so it's super easy to eat that breakfast because you want it. Whereas initially, maybe you didn't. So there is kind of a period of time when you are coming back from underfueling where you more or less have to push through and eat when you don't feel hungry, which I know can be really difficult. But going more by that rule of thumb, like eating every 3 to 4 hours can help. And I think I talked about this either in a previous episode or maybe it was in my newsletter, but something I've had athletes do if they do struggle with appetite in the morning, as in they're not feeling hungry in the morning, sometimes I'll have them start with a wake-up snack, so something small instead of trying to jump into a big meal. And this could be something like a muffin or a banana and peanut butter, energy bites, you know, something that's small that has some amount of carbs and protein, just to help kind of get your body going. And once your body recognizes that it's going to have an exogenous source, so some fuel from the outside instead of having to produce it from within, your stress hormones are going to get a little lower. It's going to be like, okay, we're safe enough. We don't need to, you know, control blood sugar. We're going to get the food that we need to give us that energy. And then it gets a little bit easier over time. So Courtney, to me, it sounds like it's probably a reflection of the fact that you're doing a better job with your fueling. But if you notice that the hunger is waking you up early or it's affecting you falling asleep, those are situations where it might be a sign of underfueling and to make a couple of corrections. This next question says, thoughts on caffeine pills or beetroot juice shots before track races? Yeah, this is a great one. So the term ergogenic aid, I may have thrown this around before, an ergogenic aid is a substance that naturally improves performance. So both caffeine and beetroot are known ergogenic aids, meaning that we have research to back up the fact that they can make a difference when it comes to performance. That said, there is different research in terms of the type of performance. So whether we're doing sprints or lifting or endurance activity, or, you know, what we're trying to improve, whether that's muscle contraction or time to fatigue, there's different aspects that we take a look at in research around some of those ergogenic aids. So starting with caffeine, this is a very well-known ergogenic aid. We have a lot of research that says caffeine can improve performance, and a couple of ways in which it can do that. One, it can improve the strength of muscle contractions. So especially when we're looking at something like lifting or speed, we do see that have an impact on muscle recruitment, which is cool. Caffeine can also prolong time to exhaustion or fatigue, which obviously is very beneficial for endurance performance. And interestingly enough, one of my favorite things that I've seen in research about caffeine is the fact that it can lower your perception of pain, which is very interesting. So from a mental standpoint, it can improve cognition, it can help with focus and motivation, and it can help reduce your perception of pain, which is really cool. So there's definitely some promising research when it comes to caffeine. The way that we want to use caffeine is pretty specific, though. Most of these research studies have looked at very specific quantities. And what we're looking for is 3 to 6 milligrams of caffeine per kilogram of body weight. So for a roughly 130-pound athlete, that's around 170 to about 350 milligrams of caffeine. And the most ergogenic effects have been observed when that is consumed 60 minutes prior to exercise. So we do know that it takes about 60 minutes for caffeine to peak in the body. So if we're thinking about, you know, using a caffeinated gel during a race, for example, the last caffeine gel that you'd want to take should be about an hour out from your projected finish time. So like for me, for example, I'm going to have a caffeinated gel around the 2 hour mark. And that's something that just will make sure you get the full effect. You can certainly take one closer to the end, and some people might feel that, whether that's placebo or not, they might feel a difference, and that's totally fine. But that's generally how it's recommended to use caffeine. So prior to an event, 60 minutes beforehand, that's when, if you're wanting to kind of use that for the start of a race, that's typically when athletes would ask me about caffeine pills. I don't love caffeine pills in general. I would much rather an athlete get caffeine from either a real food source or something like a caffeinated sports drink like Noon or Scratch, even like Run Gum, you know, something that's a little bit more standardized. The issue with caffeine pills is a lot of the brands that sell caffeine pills are kind of sketchy. And as I've mentioned before with supplements, they're not regulated. So it's a little, I would say, higher risk to use a caffeine pill because we don't know exactly what's in there. And, you know, especially if they say something like there's a proprietary blend. Proprietary blend is just a fancy way of saying there's all these things in the supplement and we don't know what quantity of each thing is in here. A lot of times it'll be the highest quantity of the cheapest substance. So if it says like caffeine from proprietary blend and there's all these other herbs in there, chances are the amount of caffeine that you're getting is not the dose that's on the bottle. So just, you know, being mindful of like, what brand is this? Are they third party tested? What are the ingredients in there? Is it just isolated caffeine? Where is that caffeine coming from? You know, those are questions that I would generally have. The other issue that I have with caffeine pills is that it can be easier to overdo it. And the way that we metabolize the caffeine can be different, especially when we're thinking about synthetic versus naturally occurring caffeine. So for example, if somebody wanted to have, let's say 170 milligrams of caffeine before their race, you know, two shots of espresso would get you there roughly. Caffeine pills can definitely overshoot that. Some of the doses that you'll see in caffeine pills are like 300 plus milligrams of caffeine, which would be way too high. So it does depend on the person and their size in terms of whether or not that's something that would even be safe to use. And I would say there's other better options out there. So again, like a caffeinated gel or a caffeinated sports drink or coffee, tea, like those might be better options for you for race day, just to avoid any potential risk that might come along with a supplement that we don't really know what's in there. The other thing to keep in mind with caffeine is that everybody is a bit different when it comes to the way their body metabolizes it. So we do see genetic differences in how we metabolize or break down caffeine. Some people are caffeine sensitive, some people are not. There is a point at which caffeine can hinder instead of help performance. And for different people, that can be different points. So if somebody never has caffeine, or when they do have caffeine, they notice that they feel really anxious, like their heart rate really ramps up, they feel really sweaty or hot. Like those are symptoms that probably wouldn't align with helping you on race day, especially when we're thinking about nerves. If we're overloading that central nervous system, that's not going to help us with performance. But like for me, for example, I drink caffeine every day. I know how my body responds to it. I know how it feels. And I'm going to drink a reasonable amount of coffee on race day, and that's going to be fine. So making sure too that you have practiced with caffeine, that you know how you respond to it, you know what dose is appropriate for you. And then the last thing I'll say with caffeine is I don't recommend going over 400 to 500 milligrams total in a day. So that's where caffeine pills can easily put you over that edge, especially if you're having them before the race and then you want to use caffeinated gels during. So just being mindful of that. And especially for drug tested athletes and NCAA athletes, pro athletes, 500 milligrams of caffeine is the upper limit. After that, it's actually considered a banned substance. So you do want to be careful with caffeine pills because, again, that's where you're more likely to overshoot that number. In terms of beetroot juice, this is something that's called a vasodilator. So we've seen that beetroots can help improve blood flow by dilating or increasing the size of blood vessels. And it does this through something called dietary nitrates. So not the nitrates that are found in like, you know, cured meats like bacon. This is a dietary form of nitrates that turn into nitric oxide in the blood and help improve blood flow. So yes, there is definitely evidence that beetroot can help improve performance. In terms of how to use that, that's something that, you know, leading up to a major event, you can have a serving of beetroot every day to help improve blood flow and improve recovery. In terms of taking it right before an event, again, results there are kind of mixed with research and you have to think about the practicality of it. I'm not going to lie to you. I did try beetroot juice shots in college. My teammate Danny Jones and I would try beetroot shots. We had like a few track races where we decided to try them. Personally, can't say I noticed a big difference and I didn't love the taste. Beets are one of my least favorite foods, so I'm a little biased there, but it was a little tough to get down. Something else to keep in mind is that it does turn your urine red. So I was very alarmed after my race and thought something was extremely wrong with me the first time I tried the beetroot shot. So just know that is a side effect that can happen. But again, there's no harm to beetroot. It's a whole food. It's a natural ingredient. Again, using a beetroot juice instead of a capsule or a powder just eliminates some of the risk that comes along with supplements. It's not harmful to try if you wanted to try it, but generally speaking, for most of these things, I encourage athletes to focus first and foremost on their fueling and hydration plan going into the race. You know, maybe the beetroot shot could give you a little bit of an edge, but it doesn't make up for not fueling well or hydrating well before a race. So you want to make sure you have that structure in place before you try something like beetroot juice. But again, not harmful. And especially if you like it, definitely a good source of nutrients and a good way to help support performance overall. Okay, our last question for today is a marathon themed question, of course. This question comes from Krista. Krista says, "Hi Maddie, I'm loving this podcast. Thank you for all you do. I have a question about overfueling. About a month ago, I ran my goal race for the year, the Bronx 10 miler. I tried to be mindful about upping my carbs the week leading up to it and ended up getting a ton of pasta, bagels, crackers, muffins, rice, and potatoes. A few days in, I started having stomach issues, nausea, diarrhea, and a lot of bloating that lasted throughout the rest of the week. The morning of my race, my stomach was a wreck. I forced down a bagel with a banana and peanut butter, electrolytes, and a full water. Once the race started, I felt awful and so nauseous I couldn't take in any fuel. I ended up finishing okay, but I felt really disappointed, knowing I could have run faster without the stomach and mental distress. What happened to me and how do I avoid this in the future? What is the best way to carb load? Thank you again. I'll be rooting for you in NYC." Thank you, Krista. Really great question, really timely question. So the first thing I'll say for carb loading, the most important piece of executing a carb load is making sure that you're eating enough carbs leading up to the carb load. So it sounds like Krista, you know, maybe like a week before was being mindful of that carb intake, and that's when she started noticing the GI distress. Chances are the carb intake in the weeks prior to that, so throughout the entire block, was either not adequate or the way in which she ramped up was too aggressive and that her body was not really able to tolerate that. So that first and foremost is why I really encourage people who are running marathons to start working with a dietitian when your training block starts, because getting enough carbs on a daily basis throughout your entire block, not just the week before the race, can really help prevent any GI distress from happening when it is time to carb load. It just makes it a lot easier if you're only adding an additional, you know, 200 grams of carbs instead of if you're adding an extra 400 grams of carbs, which maybe sounds like what was happening here with Krista. Your body just really won't tolerate that well. The other issue, a lot of times what happens with upping carb intake so extremely like that is that we are not getting enough fiber. So sometimes that can affect GI movements in general, and hydration as well. You know, we need fluids, we need sodium to absorb carbohydrates in the gut. So if we're not hydrating more in addition to adding more of those carbs, we might see more GI distress. There is a chance too, because her symptoms sound pretty extreme, there could be a chance that you were exposed to something. Foodborne illness is so common. most of us don't realize that we're exposed to some type of foodborne pathogen at least once a week. And some of us react to it, some of us don't. It definitely depends on how our stomach is and generally, you know, the immune system in our gut health overall. Some people are more sensitive to those kinds of things, but it also could just be that you picked up a GI pathogen. That does unfortunately happen leading up to the race and could potentially explain some of these symptoms. But I would say generally what I would recommend, so assuming that you're doing a good job throughout your block with your carbs, we want to think of the carb load as increasing carbs to getting 10 to 12 grams of carbohydrates per kilogram of body weight for about 2 to 3 days prior to the race. And depending on your body size, that might look like a lot of carbs. If that's the case, aiming more for like a 3 day or a longer period carb load and trying to just focus on simple foods to add more carbs. So it could be that the bulk of the foods was too much for her digestive system. So maybe instead of adding like bagel, potatoes, banana, all these things together, maybe you add a glass of juice with each meal. If you added one glass of juice or lemonade with each meal, that's almost an additional 100 grams of carbs without changing the volume of food that you're eating. You could also do something like add a packet of fruit snacks or applesauce squeeze pouch with each meal. That's another additional at least 50 grams of carbs for the day without really adding much bulk. Simple things would be instead of like all of a sudden adding in all these things, swapping out something that you're already doing for something that's a little higher carb. So if you're having a bar, like a Clif Bar, for example, Bobo's Oat Bars are a really great source, a higher carb bar option. So just kind of trying to look at the simplest way to approach it without feeling like you're force feeding yourself. Because that is definitely, I would say, an issue a lot of athletes have. They feel like this carb load is going to be so extreme, which if we're not eating enough carbs during our training block, it can be, but it shouldn't ever feel like you're force feeding yourself. If we overload our GI tract with too much of that food at once, we're not going to digest it well, it's not going to feel good, and we're going to have more GI distress for the race itself, like Krista experienced. So instead, we want to just eat until we're comfortably full and do our best with that carb load using some of those additional tools. If you're new to the idea of carb loading and you're not working with a practitioner to help you execute it, I would personally tell you to err on the side of feeling comfortable and being slightly under on that carb load than forcing the carb load at all expenses and feeling like Krista did on race day. And then potentially for your next marathon, having a little bit more of a calculated approach to it. And the way that I would explain marathon nutrition, you know, most of us don't train for a marathon without a coach. Most of us have somebody who's helping us understand what kind of workouts are going to make us the most ready for race day. They're going to, you know, periodize our training based on how far out from the race we are, what our goal pace is, how to get there in terms of building up volume. The same goes for nutrition, but a lot of us don't think of nutrition in that way. It is a tool that's in the background the entire time that you're training for a marathon. So having an additional resource when it comes to fueling for a marathon can make a huge, huge difference with something like this carb load. And what's super cool about a carb load, if it's executed properly, we can see that improve performance by up to 3%. So for a 3 hour marathon, that's equivalent to 5.4 minutes. That is the difference between running 3 hours and running 255, which is huge. And that is without changing anything about your training. That's what's so cool to me about things like nutrition. You can only train so hard. You can only do so much with your training. But we can get those little extra percentage points by doing things like the fueling, the strength training, the PT, things that we can do outside of training that make a huge difference with the way that our body responds to training and how ready we are for race day. So fun little fact about carb loading there, definitely something to think about. And I would say, you know, in the future for you, Krista, maybe trying out some different versions of mini carb loads leading into your last few long runs before your marathon. So, you know, let's say you had like a 20 miler, an 18 miler, and another 20 miler. like using those long run days to kind of do a dry run of race day. So practicing with a carb load a day or two before, practicing with your hydration, kind of getting a feel for what that feels like, really being intentional about hitting your carb needs throughout your entire training block, and then potentially using some of those lower volume sources of carbs like juices, Gatorade, Scratch, energy chews, fruit snacks, applesauce squeeze pouches, smoothies, you know, things like that, where we can get some extra carbs that don't take up so much space in our stomach. And then the last thing that just popped into my mind also is thinking about how we're spreading things out throughout the day. If we were just eating three meals and trying to get enough carbs at those three meals, that would also be another situation where it's going to be stretching our GI tract too far to the edges of its capabilities. So making sure that you're still getting snacks throughout the day, you know, being mindful with travel as well, that you're not going long stretches without eating. Having that consistency as well really helps execute the carb load. Really great question, Krista, and hopefully I'll see you out there in New York. Thanks everyone for the great questions, and thank you all for the support. If you're going to be in New York City for race weekend, I'm co-hosting a shakeout run with Chris Lee, who was also on the podcast a couple months ago. He's a strength and conditioning coach based out of Boulder with Kinesis Integrated. We are hosting a shakeout run together Saturday morning at 9:30 from Joe Coffee Company on West 68th. So I'll put the link to register for that in the show notes. It's free. We're just trying to get a general head count because Chris generously offered to buy coffee for everybody. And last I heard, we were at 100 people. So he is being very generous buying coffee. Please feel free to come. I'd love to meet you in person. And I hope everyone has a fantastic weekend. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of the Fueling Forward podcast. If you'd like to submit a question to be answered on air in a future episode, you can do so on my website at www.fuelingforward.com under the podcast tab, or you can email me at fuelingforwardpodcast@gmail.com. Next week's episode will be an interview with Jess McLean. She is one of the top US marathoners right now, and she's an incredible person with a great story. So I hope that you'll tune in next week. Thanks again for being here, and I'll see you at the next Fueling Forward Friday.